This is a fugitive text. This is. Yeah, I kind of want to read a poem.
Yeah, please.
It's called Notes Towards the Integration of a Traumatic Event or the Scene of My Own Subjection. When it was my body getting done it to, there was no water beneath the boy I mistook. Depersonalization for magic. I even thanked him for making me the impossible, a woman. I closed myself up to indulge a fantasy of belonging. Silly girl born child, the only thing belonged to is tradition. Wasn't the first, and despite prayer, won't be the last of invaded territories. Body a would-be ledger of control and discipline. Flesh something in between, and always has been. Listen, the women who bear to remember won't let us forget our rape is a non-event, like freedom. No, that's somebody else talking. It happened, and I believe. But did you mean to say it like that? Do you dare name a man responsible? Listen, when it was my body, down there, beneath the boy, love succumbed, power unmade me in the belly of my foremothers. How many of us held supine and called crazy? It takes a crime to mark criminal, and a subdued negress is the expected fodder of this exchange. Ain't a thing here to be redressed. More than that kind of legibility, I need to sound it out in my own time. Fix my lips round words like harm and survivor, but still keep breathing deep, deeper.
Yup. You are listening to Abolitionish, Black politics and culture podcast at the end of the world, or so they say. These episodes are recorded virtually via Riverside FM from Mexico City, Mexico, and I am humbled to be your host. My name is John Moore, and you can follow me on Twitter at incivility. That's incivilitea. The Abolitionish podcast and our monthly zine, Endnotes, are produced by Johannesburg-based agender artist and astrologer in training, Who's Wiley, aka featuring Wiley, and you can follow them on Twitter at Who's Wiley, WHOSWYLEE. You can also hit up their TikTok at Venusian Wannabe, that's VenusianWannabe. And get your celestial shit together. We would also fail to function without our social media director, Bug, who comes to us by way of Billy. I am so humbled and excited to kick it with my friend, the now doctor, Ra Malaika Imhotep, for season 3, episode 4 of the podcast. Ra Malaika Imhotep is a Black feminist writer and performance artist and cultural worker from Atlanta, Georgia. Their intellectual and creative work tends to the relationships between queer embodiment, Black femininity, vernacular culture, and the performance of labor. They co-convene an embodied spiritual political education project called the Church of Black Feminist Thought. They're a member of the Black Aesthetic and the proud child of D. Makita Johnson and Akbar Imhotep. Ra's work has been published in Women in Performance and The Breakout Poets Volume 2, Black Girl Magic, among others. And most recently, in April of this year, Ra Malaika's debut collection of poetry, Gossipin, was published by Red Hen Press. Inspired by the plant medicine latent in Gossypium herbaceum, or cotton root bark, which was used by enslaved Black women to induce labor, cure reproductive ailments, and end unwanted pregnancies, Gossipin is an arrangement of stories, secrets, and memories experienced, read, heard, reimagined, and remixed. Ra Malaika is joining the podcast to reflect on Black process and Black place, their own journey through grad school and their first poetry collection, and share a bit from what I think is really just a truly incredible collection of poems. So we are all lucky as fuck for it. And I invite you to sit back, kick your feet up, and enjoy the ride. When did, because I know we talked before and you said that a lot, some of these poems had been with you a while.
Yeah.
When did you first get the inkling that like you might have a collection? So, because full disclosure, so I'm in this, I don't know if you know the poet Angel Nafis. So Angel was teaching a year-long like writing towards your manuscript class mm-hmm. with Catapult that I'm in and have been in since what, January? Mm-hmm. So I'm like trying to, we're on like summer break now, but I'm trying to stay in the like manuscript mode, at least like not certainly not in writing, but just like thinking about like what thought goes into creating, editing, mm-hmm. ordering, mm-hmm. pushing through something like a manuscript. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's been interesting to hear like folks come and talk to the class about when they thought they had a manuscript. Like, you know, for some people that's the language they use. For others, it's like I set out to do this mm-hmm. thing, and then in 2 years the thing had been done. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I'm curious like what that was like for you.
Yeah, I mean, so shout out to my doula, Alan Pelez Lopez, who basically was like, you have a manuscript. I honestly think they were in a season of telling several of their friends, like, you're a poet, you've been writing, you're an artist, stop playing, you have a manuscript, pull it together. And they kind of like coached me through the like conception of the volume, which was a lot of really just holding and taking myself seriously, gathering, collecting, looking over like just things I had jotted down and written and documents that I had kind of shoved away. Because again, like the writing had been, you know, my, to quote June Jordan, like the thing I do in the dark, like the whole while, right? Like since I had been, I've been writing poems for a very long time, like since middle school or something. But like, I just had a lot of material and also was still in the practice of like processing through poetry throughout grad school. So Alan kind of gave me the push to take myself seriously and really consider that I could have a manuscript. Like it wasn't even a thought in my head. And then when I started gathering things, I was in the Bay, I was taking herbalism classes, I was learning about plant allies. I was in this class at a place called Ancestral Apothecary where they were like, we were invited to like find an ancestral plant medicine. And that's when I got this Gullah Geechee Herbal Remedies book, and it had a cotton plant was in it. And I was like, what do you mean cotton is medicine? I'm not understanding. And I learned that the root of the cotton plant had been used as an abortificin. And that kind of became like the basket that held all the poems that I had been collecting as I was really kind of like viscerally moving through a lot of feelings around my body and like failing biological expectations. At the time I was really like, so I was thinking about like what I was then understanding is my like reproductive dysfunction. So cotton root bark was used to induce labor, to cause abortions or to facilitate abortions. Mm-hmm. Also to just stimulate the uterine organs. So both kind of like as an aphrodisiac, but also to bring on an absentee period. I'm a person with like PCOS and like elevated androgen, like there's things going on in my body that means I don't bleed regularly. And I was really stressed by that. Having that question, that set of questions or that set of anxieties on my heart and in my body as I was doing this herbalism class and being brought in deeper relationship with cotton root bark, while I'm also holding all this kind of memory writing that I had been doing about like my ancestors and their stories, and like really like in the aftermath of my own experiences of sexual violence, really like intentionally calling in my ancestors, even without knowing that it was all about slavery. I feel like that was a big jump, but like I was doing all this work, right? While I'm in grad school, but I'm doing all this work trying to like reconstitute myself and trying to like understand this being, this body that I'm in, and it's taking me into all these places, some dark corners, some like spaces of exuberance, and it's all bringing me back to these very real like cotton fields and like plantation stories and plantation folklores and things like that. And so I feel like I wish that I had been journaling throughout the process so I could be like, yes, and then one day it clicked. But I just know that I was feeding myself all of this information that felt absolutely necessary for my survival, because I was so stressed and depressed and like desperate for understanding, to like circle back to like not legibility but understanding. And out of that desperation, I came to understand that the stories and the poems spoke together. Like some poems were started and drafted when I was in college processing like my rape, but not being able to call it that, right? And then, so now I'm several years later in a new place where I'm confronted with that and having to do all this work and therapy around that incident and then revising these reflections of that moment. So it just was like a lot of like time warpy reckoning, and I think it became a manuscript. Like, I don't even know if I was consciously like the manuscript didn't feel like a writerly goal for me. It felt like I'm piecing together a basket. Like, I'm giving myself this project that's gonna help me sublimate a new word I learned recently, that's gonna help me make sense of what's going on in my body. And so I think crafting the manuscript was like a coping mechanism. And then once I felt like I had something, and it was initially titled Cotton Root Bark, I went back to Alan, my doula, and was like, okay, what now? And they gave me a list of places that had open submission periods. And then that's what I did with it. But I think the insight that I just got from that swirl of words I just said was that it wasn't a writerly goal for me at first. Like, it was a very like personal project.
No, that's real. I'm so happy you shared that, because so I feel like I started the podcast because I was like, I don't have anywhere to go to hear the stories of people. I don't have anywhere to go to hear the stories of Black people in grad school when they were there. You know, like, Eula could tell us about her days, but it's not, you know, 27-year-old professor. It's them now, like, through with all the knowledge they have now. And like, sometimes that's what you need, and sometimes that's not what I need. Like, I need to. And so, likewise, as I've been in this manuscript class and just trying to write, trying to return to writing, I've been kind of frustrated by how rare it is to find younger poets talking about their first collection and it not be, I set out to write this thing. Like, it's a helpful reminder of how it can just come to be, because of the work you're doing. Like, you don't need to set to do it for you to always be doing that work. And like what you said about like, you know, revising the poems as your language for them. Not necessarily language superficially, but like you're not just editing them for the feeling or the aesthetic, but you're also editing for like, is this what I mean? Is this what happened? Is this how I want to say it? Which I feel like I just really appreciate hearing that. Cause you know, I feel like, and I'm biased, cause you know, and Chai's gonna be my ass, but you know, the formalism game be making me mad, the editors be making me mad. And it's not cause I don't respect it and cherish it, I do. It's just that that's not my natural mind state, you know? Like, I feel like my natural mind state is a little less tidy. And so, yeah, I appreciate you sharing that.
Yeah, I think there's something, I feel privileged that I got to make a book without feeling like I needed to be validated as the most brilliant Black poet in the world. You know, like I feel privileged that I got to make a book without having like pure writerly aspirations. And that I got to bring a book into the world without having to, you know, jump through the hoops and loops of the like prize industry. And that's no shade to like my loved ones who are brilliant poets who have gotten their works into the world through those channels. But I just feel like it feels different and it feels a little.
Yeah,
it just feels, it feels like a different walk. And it's also a good reminder that there are Black poets publishing always, even when they're not having like the big shiny fanfare around every publication. Like there are Black poets publishing. And it also feels like a gift in that, like, yeah, I got to be self-important. Like I got to be introspective and self-forward in all the ways that were necessary for the integration that this book holds.
Yeah. In Angel's class a few weeks ago, there was a poet that came named Jenny Chi, and she was talking about how her first book was published through a prize and how it was a weird experience and how like these first books are, maybe all of publishing is, but these like weird lotteries that depending on your time and place, but even though they're so like wanton and like it is easy to leave them still feeling like no, that was meant to happen.
Yeah, and they were. I think it's just like, and this holds in the academy too. I think of the words in the path of somebody like Alexis Pauline Gums, possibility model par excellence, poet, writer, Black feminist troublemaker, who has said like, it's always important to remember that there are so many ways to do the work of being a Black intellectual. Right, like when, and this is a direct quote from her, but like when Du Bois first got his PhD, there were no tenure track positions available to him. And so there are all these other ways to be in the world as a Black intellectual. And I think sometimes, at least in my experience, it was easy to foreclose those other ways because there's like a goal, you know, you're in grad school, you move towards the professorate, and it's just like a machine that keeps giving. And I was saying the other day that sometimes I feel like it's designed to keep you so like dizzy with accomplishment that you just like keep moving because it's just like, ah, yes, this must be where it's like a fucking carrot, you know, that keeps moving. And I feel similarly about poems. And even though I do not feel authorized to say nothing about like the world of poets, like, you know, the poetry scene. Like, I don't feel like I know enough to know. But I think that there's a way that, like, even as a debut author in this moment, like, I can see how like the prize circuit moves and works differently when it comes to like PR and all that kind of stuff. And it's easy to be like, oh, snap skis, like, should I have held the book until da 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 da? So I think it feels good to like, one, you know, comparison is the thief of joy. But two, just to be like, oh, there are so many ways to be a Black intellectual in this moment, a Black creative intellectual in this moment and beyond. And yeah, and I mean, you've like self-published, and I was just gonna say, like, I come from a self-publishing people. Like, my father is a poet, my mother is like a cultural worker. People, I come from real like entrepreneurial. If I got a call, if I got an idea, I'm gonna put it out there any means necessary. And I think that's important to remember.
Yeah, no, for sure. Yeah, it's like, you know, you can try to avoid the industry, but for what other industry, you know? Like, for what other industry? Maybe two or three weeks ago, there was a panel of some Black grad students that have been talking to Joy James about Captain Maternal stuff. And I was there, and one of the things that kept coming up was like people trying to get some clarity around like why. Like, why stay? Like, why captive? Mm-hmm. And, you know, Joy just had this refrain of like, because what else? it's easy for us to like, it's easy for someone to, not exceptionalize, but like, make weird or like, to problematize staying when you're not talking about what leaving entails. Yeah. You know, what happens when you say no? Mm-hmm. It's not just dissatisfaction.
Yes, facts. I'm so happy you went there, because as I was talking, I was thinking of last summer, I think like the organization Black Feminist Futures had this like Canon summer school, and Joy James was one of the speakers. It was Joy James, Saidiya Hartman, and C. Riley Snorton. And lots of things occurred. But what came up for me is that, you know, I was there, I was like brought on to do some like grounding work, and Joy James was like, that was beautiful. And then at some point in the weekend, I don't know if it was right after or in her remarks or maybe at the closing, like, she basically called me a baby captive maternal. And she was talking about not just me in general, but just like this, there's like a, like she was seeing like this cohort of people, or maybe cohort's not the word, but just seeing folks, like a grouping of folks who are doing this, who are called in these ways towards like what we could call like Black feminist scholarship, Black feminist culture work, Black feminist organizing, and like how they move and they open space and hold space in this way. And she was talking about baby captive maternal. So as I, that was coming up for me, and then you were like, phew. And I really, there's this moment in Wayward Lives where Saidiya is also like, don't ask why she do it, as if it could be done differently. Like, sure, we can say how crappy it is and how it's not fair, but like, what else is there?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, so reckoning with that. Like, yes. Great work. Yes, yes.
As I write my dissertation about Black femininity and labor.
Okay, so that's an early question I have that really precedes these. So I don't know if I was talking to Kevin or somebody, but they were like, I was talking about like what I would do if I came back. Like, I wouldn't come back if I didn't have a dissertation, mm-hmm. basically like on my ass, ready mm-hmm. to go. And they were like, oh, you could always do something that's not purely theoretical, like if you're writing poetry when you're gone, like you could find a way to integrate mm-hmm. it. And I was like, is anyone actually doing that? Before you even ask the question of what that would mean on a Monday. Your point of having to be 10 different people at once, like, pretty sure being the esoteric poet is not going to give me whatever. But anywho, especially the poems I'll be writing, we're not on some Amanda Gorman show here. It's not giving. But I had this question in my mind. I was like, wait, is Rob's book dissertation work?
Child, I wish.
That's a trip. That's fucking nuts. I hope people have told
this
you that.
Book is like, this is fugitive. This is a fugitive text. This is like, what do they call it? Like, this is the shadow dissertation. So that's like, the shadow family to my diss work. But I will say that before I left, when I took my like DCF and I went to New Orleans, and then like I was ready to take a leave of absence. Like I was literally like, okay, y'all, I'm sick. My family's sick. Can't do this. And they was like, well, a lot of people feel this way going up to Qualls, like, see what happens. And like, let's figure out how to get you to keep your health insurance, which is real. And I was not thinking about that. But when I left to New Orleans, like I had a conversation with my advisor that was like, I have this feeling that I'm just going to come back with a bunch of writing and then we'll make it a dissertation. And that like didn't fully happen, but it basically happened where like, I like worked really intensely over one document that became a chapter and then like had little pieces of writing that became other chapters. But no, it's like, I can't really say they're completely different worlds, because I think like if my dissertation is about like Black femininity and the performance of labor, the poems like are thinking about like reproductive labors and reproductive dysfunctions in a way that's like super relevant and that isn't fully discussed in the dissertation. So like they, you know, they cousins, they kinfolk. But it is wild to imagine, to hold the reality that I produced those two bodies of work at the same time.
Yeah. My grammar would be bonkers. That would be capital, all capital. but yeah, like real for all the reasons that we know. But that's really interesting. So like, so if the poems have this element of, like the reproductivity, you feel like that's not, it's not super reflected in the diss work because of what the dissertation is, or is there something about the nature of it that you're like, actually like the poem is a much more homey place for them, or like it just so happened, like they happened in the poem and not the diss work?
I really like this question. And what's coming up for me is that like, the poems are very inside the body, both like the body that is mine, that is the narrator's, that is the family body, but it's up in it, where I think the dissertation is following those bodies and watching those bodies and bearing witness to those bodies. But it's way more about like, what are the methods of holding the body? And that was a decision I think that I made. I was like, I don't want to be about the work of translating interiority
and all these things
to a public. Like, I really want the dissertation to be this experiment, and like, what tools can I use to hold this like soft, adaptive Black feminine flesh thing, this surviving thing? Like, what are the methodological, like, how do you write about it, which was and is a very external thing, even though like my last chapter is like, you know, autoethnographic performance studies stuff about my own performance work. But again, that's like on the outside of the body, whereas the poems are like really internally engaging, like survivals, particularly around like reproductive labor, reproductive dysfunction, and sexual violence, which is present. And like the diss is so much about like how like Black women and gender nonconforming Black femme artists are using aesthetic practices to like make sense of all the ways that their bodies are marked. And I talk about my performance work in the diss, but I think the poetry book was like the very kind of like necessity driven me working, like me doing the work I describe in the dissertation, but like as it related to like intergenerational traumas that like I don't think belonged in that academic document in the same way, you know. And I don't want to have to, you know, like justify stuff. Like I could just say the things, you know, in the poems.
Yeah, no, I really fuck with that. When I got to the end and I saw the Barbara Christian pull from the Race for Theory, I was like really intrigued by how, because I'm trying to remember what are like we have. Right. Yeah, I was really intrigued by how like we have whatchamacallit, what we gathered here to do, which for me is kind of like this introduction that's also an abstract, that's also a history, that's also just like, setting the table, clearing your throat, letting people know what won't come out. Just like, I don't know. I really fucked with it for a lot of reasons. I think because of how concerned it seemed with not being legible but being understood, And I'm like, yeah, they don't really teach us that. I'm like, because I'm just like, if you have something like what we gathered here to do at the top of a disc, your advisor's like, why are you telling us this now? Or like, this, or like it's serving the function of an abstract and not like it's not concerned with the reader, it's concerned with like itself, But yeah, when I got to the end and I saw the Barbara Christian quote, I was like, oh, this is dope because it's not like, I don't know. Sometimes I'm like, enticed to start something in a poem because I think the theory I fuck with what it does well is like it just gets to the thing, like it gets to it, doesn't play with you, doesn't play with its food, it just gets to it. So the fact that we get something like that at the end, I don't know, I really fucked with it because it was like, I mean, it was certainly in the vein of what Christian is talking about, writing to save one's life. And that would necessarily mean like I don't need to contextualize this for you with theory. I can just as well contextualize this line from The Race for Theory with my poet, with the poems. Like the poem serving as like the lead up or the context to the, I was like, okay, I like that.
See, this is one trip of like putting things in the world, and like that, like the greatest gift that I felt in like doing like creative work, like producing creatively alongside like academic work, is that you really get the experience of like you follow spirit or you follow impulse and you put something together and then other people get it and it works on them in a way that you designed, but it wasn't even all super yeah. It's like you arrived at the same conclusions that I did, despite me not having sat down and like been like, oh, I'm gonna put this Christian at the end and that's really gonna get them, you know? But there's something about putting a book together and like the impulses and then the way that that text can like reintroduce itself to you and then even be reflected back in conversation with others, that is really a treat to me. And yeah, I think when even when I was crafting or deciding that there would be this like introductory moment, it did feel like self-important, you know, like you like it is concerned with itself, and it felt kind of like I was like, do poets do this? Like I feel like you're supposed to let other people like, you know, pave the way. But then it felt really important because how often do I get to really like plant myself in a position towards like authorship, particularly also because I'm thinking through like the histories my bodies carry and family histories and with no like fidelity to the ways that those families or those names might move or what they might mean to other folks that I'm related to, right? It felt necessary to be like, this is what this experiment is. And there is a precedent for it. Like people do be writing these little things. And I liked also the reflection that it's like not concerned with being legible, but concerned with being understood. Because I'm also like, ain't that what we want? Like, that just feels like such a true reflection of the place that I've gotten. I remember being so preoccupied with legibility when I started grad school and feeling so illegible, even within like a Black Studies department, feeling like people was not checking for me because they ain't know what I was doing. But also, I didn't know what I was doing. So how was we supposed to, you know, like if the thing I have to do to be deserving of your attention is know what I'm doing, then like how would I ever figure it out, you know?
Yeah. How can I trust myself to begin that? Yeah.
Yeah, like where's the invitation? But I think when Jasmine Johnson, who I worked with in undergrad, who is also an alum of our program and is like badass dance studies, Black feminist scholar and practitioner, was like, sometimes illegibility, like, are you illegible or are you like at a breaking point? Like, are you cutting new ground? Like, and is that what this wall is? And I was like, well, shout out to that reframe, because it gave me something back to myself. And that's something that I find in Christian, like in Horton Spillers, in that whole cohort of sometimes aligned and sometimes not aligned Black feminist theorists from the 80s. Like, I feel that like invitation to just really be self-important, to understand that I got something to say and I got a way that I need to say it.
Right. I'm thinking of this video I saw, someone pulled it on Twitter, of Horton speaking. I don't know, you've probably seen it. Somebody asked her in the audience like some question about legibility and the language she uses, and her answer is like, I use those words because that's what the fuck I meant.
Period.
Like, and I mean I'm really and it's maybe because I am always thinking from the position of an older sibling, or just because I like the classroom, but like, and maybe this is a novel, but like, I am, I think, sometimes troubled by how there's a certain fetish for legibility that doesn't even ask the question about, like, it presumes that there's, it presumes that whatever is, whatever there is to be understood, is legible, and it can be, which I think then presumes like all these universalities about who are you fucking talking to and who are you and all these things. But yeah, that's dope. That's dope.
Yeah, and I think of Barbara Christian and Spillers on this point because they aren't in alignment, but they inform so much of how I make decisions when I come to a page, whether that's for a poem or a essay, which is like, Spillers is very much like I think she has a quote, like she's in a interview where she's like, I wanted to make all those like white philosopher people speak my language. So she brought them to Memphis and she imposed her know-how onto them using their terms, whereas Barbara Christian is very disinterested and skeptical of those terms. And I think that the tension between those two approaches feels very generative to me, because I think that there is a way. I also had to realize in grad school that everything is subjective. Like, something that I think is illegible is like water to somebody else, and something that I think is legible is illegible to other people. And like, that was another one of these like rivers I had to cross in this last little bit of school, because then you get there and you're like, oh, I was supposed to be writing for the people, but what if the people don't like it? It's too much. But I ultimately think, oh, there's a Toni Morrison quote that I don't have committed to memory, where she's like, she wanted the language to be sophisticated enough to please her, but also still like clear enough to be felt. And I think that's what I'm invested in. You know, like, I want the words to convey a feeling that is perceptible, even if you don't know what prefixes and suffixes are doing in this moment. You know, I want the language to be able to be felt. And that has been my compass in the dissertation and in the poems. I just think in poetry, you don't have to offer explanations. You can just do it. And people kind of know it's subjective. Because, like, what makes a good poem in this moment is another, like, I have no idea.
Yeah, it feels cheap to even say that what makes a good poem right now is legibility, because it's like, I'm like, that even sounds too deep, you know? Like, when I think legible, I think I did something and I came out the other side. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, I feel like so much of, you know, the art we consume doesn't even invite that. Mm. So when did you start grad school?
2015, right after undergrad.
Oh, you like a weirdo. Mm-hmm.
From the same school, too, because...
Yeah, they be pushing you out. Go and be great.
In the same direction. It's like,
yeah. Well, shit, and look, if they're going to be throwing you out like that, it might as well be in the same direction. God damn it.
That's how I agree with that. I feel it. This does not make sense, but they say that I'm one of the first, you know, like to like chart that course towards university programs. I'll be like, I'm sorry, y'all, but everybody's doing great. Everybody's doing so great.
Good. So you didn't destroy them. You didn't. Yeah. Good. Okay. So 2015, 7 years mm-hmm. to now. What were like. What did you propose in your application?
Child, it was, so I had done my undergrad thesis project honors at Brandeis University. I feel like I should say that. Shout out to the Brandeis Black Feminist Tradition. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I worked on Ghanaian popular music. So I was thinking about like diaspora, popular culture, and like, Ghanaian hip hop and the relationship between kind of like ideas of nation as like co-created through like diasporic cultural circuits. Like how is like the idea of the Afropolitan in conversation with like older ideas of Pan-Africanism. So that was where I came in at, and I wanted to take that work a step further and do kind of like a Black feminist reading of like Ghanaian hip life, which was informed one like by a couple things. One were like real instances of sexual harassment and violence I endured while like in the field, but like as an undergrad student studying abroad working on that project. And
where were you in Ghana?
I was in Ghana. Well, I have like a relationship. Like I've been to Ghana several times. I went as a volunteer doing like art therapy stuff in like 2012. And then I went back for like 6 months in like 2013 or 2014. Yeah, I'm pretty sure it was the spring of 2014. And there had been like other trips in between then. So I came in with the, like my proposal was to talk about women in West African contemporary music, Black feminist reading. What I realized I was invested in was like, and I wonder if this was actually in the statements, but I was really interested in how the language used to describe like a baddie, like a bad bitch in the like hip life songs was the same word to describe like a sex worker. Like it was like a shawo this, a shawo that. And it was like both like something that people would rep and claim and also like a put down. And so I kind of in that first year kind of realized that I was really interested in these questions around like the material and like cultural position of the sex worker and like Black popular culture. And I think just like needing into that deeper got me into a focus on like labor and like Black feminist political economies.
I'm intrigued by it being a word or like it being that like, because I don't know if that's a Black studies thing, but I hear that all the time, that like people came to their questions and projects by like they discovered the etymology of a word was something they never expected, or like, I don't know, or like something in translation. And I just don't be hearing that shit from, in meaningful ways, from people outside of, people who I feel like just didn't come out of like Black studies classrooms, if that makes sense. And I wonder what that is, like if it's, because I don't be feeling like I can close read, but then compared to some niggas, I'm like, maybe I can do it. Maybe my reading is always close because just that's just what it is. But okay, so that sounds like a proposal project in its like specificity and like its relevance. And so then, yeah, you said, so you needed it and you came to labor.
And I think it was also like, I like that you said like people turn into words in any meaningful ways, because I done been in some English classrooms where they focus on a word, but then you'd be like, where are we? Like, how do we get here? So I think there's something about Black studies that understands language as like meaningful and how we understand the world. So we're like, ooh, like we know, just like sit with the letters, you know, we go somewhere.
Yeah.
You know, somewhere different.
Yeah, like it becomes, if I'm called to like some etymological or translation shit or something, it's like, I like to think at least, it's because it's giving me a different angle on the action, but it's not a different story necessarily, or it's not a different problem. Whereas like, yeah, some of the English girls be like, well, you know, if you translate it into Bengali and then you get rid of the last five letters and then you put it in Google and then you flip your phone upside down, and you're like, yeah, that is not,
you be cut up.
Yeah, it's really not. So that that's true.
That's hilarious.
When was the first time you felt like your dissertation questions were kind of like forming into something that you could like really put your arms around in a way, or at least like talk about without being like, I think, or perhaps, if it ever happened?
Yeah, I mean, it's so slippery. Like, you know, you be cuddled up to it and then it'd be like, actually I'm a snake. You know, it's like, it's not stable at all. But I remember once when I was in New Orleans. So I moved to New Orleans in the fall of 2019 to start my like research time, and then extended my stay because of COVID and everything was virtual. But I had explained my work to a comrade there, a lovely like witchy healer being, who's also a really dope and deep organizer, Aisha, who's currently one of the co-directors of Song, Southern is a New Ground. But we were talking and I was explaining my work, and then she reflected back to me, it's like, oh, like you're interested in how capitalism lives in our bodies. And I was like, yeah, I am. That's exactly what I'm doing. And I think the fact that like whatever I had skidded out about, you know, how we are marked and how being like, because my research focus shifted away from like diaspora as like a material geography where I thought I needed to be researching at like three points. Like I had to do the triangular trade. I was trying to do a lot. I was like Caribbean, African, USF, da da da. And I realized that I could really just like touch into the US South as a diasporic location and still be successful, or still be like effective and write a compelling thing. But so I lost my train of thought a little bit, but when I was explaining how being close and in figurative and literal proximity to sites of enslavement, like we have in the US South, like a place like New Orleans, where literally everything used to be a plantation, everything used to be an auction block, at least that's what it feels like. A place like Atlanta, where there's like these like repressed histories of both like enslavement and convict leasing, like all these things that have shaped these like urban centers. And how that shifts how we move, how we process, or how it might shift how we move, how we process, how we survive, how we tell stories. And for me to kind of scat that out in this person who I really like admired in like an organizing capacity and in a creative capacity and a spiritual capacity, to be able to synthesize that I was invested in like how capitalism lives in the body, I was like, okay, I must be onto it. I'm onto something. And that has kind of carried me since. But that was what, like, I had been ABD for like a year and a half at least before that happened.
That is helpful to know.
Yeah.
And also just speaks to how like this isolationist shit don't work for us in the same way it works for other people.
It doesn't. Even if there's a lot of it that gets done alone or in your mind or like in quiet, like you, it really, reflection, dialogue, it's the lubrication, you know? It's the wetness on the ideas. I'm like, I don't know why I went there, but.
It'll work. Happy Pride Month. So what has, you said you were just getting back to the nitty-gritty of a scholar life. What has your balance been lately, if you can call it that? What is your split been?
I have to start by saying this last little bit of grad school was so hard on my brain and my body. Like, I was scared. I was literally like, is this when I lose it? Because I'm not, I don't, what? Like, is it worth it? Like, literally having conversations with Lindsay, because I'm like begging to see a psychiatrist, and they're like, well, if you graduate, then you don't have enough time to start meds. Like, it was like a lot going on. So that was happening, and I found myself like at the end of it. So at the end of May, when all the ceremonies were happening, really happy and like really relieved, but also like in a mood, like kind of in a funk, like in like a depressive moment. And that was just really uncomfortable. And it took me a while to really like be at peace with it. Cause the thing I was worried about was like, I just want to be able to be present. Like, this is like this landmark achievement that I've been working towards all this time. I done pushed and pushed and pushed. Now the thing is there, it's official. And I want to be able to enjoy that moment. And I had to have a like come to Buddha moment about the fact that like I was being present. I didn't feel good. Like, I felt a lot of different emotions, but I was present in just all the ups and downs of that period of time. All that to say, I was tired. I'm still tired, just like pure exhaustion. And so I tried my best to like offload things in June. I was like, whatever, like I'm trying to cancel appearances, trying to say no to like different things, most of which I didn't actually get out of, if I'm being honest. People were like, oh, really? We'll make it happen. And I was like, okay. But I tried. And I, so this past month, like, friends and family were literally here with me up until the end of May. And then I was like, okay, I had to do, you know, some Black feminist organizing work. So I took a little trip at the beginning of June. And then I was like, okay, no deadlines. I'm not traveling anywhere else. And then next week I'm going to like a like mindfulness retreat. So that'll be fun. So I've just been trying my best to like not have obligations or not be on anybody else's time. Cause I feel like so much of grad school and not just regular grad school, but grad school in the like overworked interdisciplinary way that I've been doing it has been so much about being on other people's time. And so I tried to give myself a month of not that. Lord knows I deserve like 7 months at least. But I'm going to give them what they need in July, and then I'm going to, maybe I'll do like a month on, a month off. But I just feel like, yeah, I guess you asked about the balance, and I feel like I haven't found a, a real balance, but I have been of necessity trying to be like, okay, right now body needs to rest. So how can I shape a week, a month for my body to rest? And then sometimes I'll have to make words happen and I'll do that. And then I'll go back rest. I'm gonna have some weird, you know, everybody's talking about sabbaticals now. And I really wanted that for myself. I want that for myself, but I think I'm gonna have to, I don't know, be creative about it, because I don't see the universe giving me a massive stretch of time. I think I'm going to have to take it how I can get it.
Yeah, that's real. Yeah, I'm often wondering, like, is that the thing I'm after? Like, the durational piece of it? Because I swear, when I do get that, I don't be using it. I'd be like, oh, I can't wait for a week to not do shit. And then when I have a week to not do shit, I just be doing shit, because I'm like, just because it's, I mean, the easiest thing is to say because I want to, and that's partially true, but it's also just so familiar. Like, it's not familiar to not do anything. It hasn't been familiar to not do anything for a long time. And the idea that you can just switch off just because you know the inherent value of it is not real.
It's not real. And, like, you know, something I had to accept is that, like, there's some experience I don't get. And maybe this is, like, I don't know if I should can't fully give into this, but anyway, like, because I have colleagues and like collaborators also in grad school who could just be like, I'm just focusing on my dissertation, and I'll be like, you know what's wild is like the economy of my Black studies experience means that I literally only get funding if I can do 1,000 things and a couple magic tricks. Like, I'm not even funded to just write, and I knew that. Like, I chose it at one point. I was like, yeah, gotta serve the people. Like, I made a conscious choice to like be
a Subway server.
You know, I tried. I wanted it. I needed it even. But then I was like, wow, I really put myself in a place where they're like, yes, you're here because not only can you read and write, you can also make us feel good. It's a lot. And so all that to say, I'd be like, not only is it unfamiliar to not do anything, like, I've yet to experience a reality. Whether I was like, had my organizer hat or my artist hat or my academic hat on, like, I've yet to experience a reality in which, like, I could not do anything and it would be okay.
Yeah. And it's important, right, to say that when you say okay, you're not talking about you feeling okay about it. You know? So I think my last question, I saw the conversation between, when was it? I forget. But it was with you and Doris Davenport and Elle. And it was really awesome. You talked a bit about, like, and this was like a bit ago, so the book had only been out a minute, but I kind of want to revisit this, like, idea of now that the book is out in the world. So you had mentioned earlier, like, you know, one of the joys of it is seeing the way that it acts on people, the way that you can hear yourself and feel yourself reflected back through the text as people engage it. Mm-hmm. And maybe, like, to go full circle to return into the PDFs, are there questions that, like, now that the text is out in the world, you're finding yourself that are, like, coming into view for you, or like, or maybe you're revisiting older questions with, like, I don't know. And it's not to sort of imply, which I think is easy to do, that, like, I mean, text can be transformative, but I think I'm also, you know, weary of this, like, they can also be painful. They can also be confusing. They can also be, like, burdensome in some ways. They can be distractions, even to ourselves, even though we're the people that made them. So, yeah, I'm just curious, like, if there are questions on the horizon that you feel like, oh, like, the publishing this, sharing it with people really did help the process.
I think that one is just been really beautiful to see how the work moves. Right, where it lands, who's holding it, how they're holding it. I just, like, last week, was it, like, the playwright, Erica Dickerson Dispenza, like, was posted this beautiful, luscious tribute, like, got the book in the bathtub, white and blue rose petals. Like, I was like, yeah, like, beyond my wildest dreams. Literally, I'm about to start blushing now. Like, and so, and then when I had a book event at MOAD with Alan and Reverend Poet Marvin K. White, who both of them were very instrumental in just really calling forth this work and really charging me to make sense of the things I was learning, particularly about the cotton root plant and just kind of like legacies of reproductive violence and survival and strategy. And Marvin had his book all like adorned. There were like three, like, cotton branches affixed to the cover. Like, throughout the book, he had put little like totems. Like, it was a work of art. And so I think I've been really curious heart opening to see how this little medicine book, as I've been calling it, just really finds its people and does its work. You know, like, it opens up a space that I feel very privileged to have had a hand in. And I think in my life personally, it's got me thinking a lot about land. It's got me thinking a lot about, just like how my stories are bound up in the stories of the land that shaped me. Even, so I have this new like spark that's in me around a project that's probably like fiction and is thinking about peaches and grief and all this stuff. And I was talking to my dad and he said, it's wild that's where you are, because by the time he was born, the cotton field that his folks had worked, the cotton field that's referenced in Gossiping, had become a peach orchard. So like, there's just, and my father has a poem where he says that his mother spent the last day of her life in a peach packing factory. And that peach packing factory was on the grounds of the cotton, of the former cotton plantation that her people once worked. And that is something that I was just, like, I was just given that story after this first story got into the world. But I think there's something about, I feel really grateful for the clearing and like the ability to put this text out and like let it do its work outside of me, because I think it's created just a way deeper, or what do I want to say? I just think it's created some space that feels really generative and aligned. Like, the fact that I'm like, you know, writing these like peach fragments and then I get this direction or this affirmation from my father about this peach orchard, and then even just like I feel very kind of enamored by it, and it's almost hard to put into language, but I think there's just something that I'm learning about telling the stories you feel called to tell when you feel called to tell them, and just letting them fall as they need to fall. So the fact that I think there's a line in that like introductory, what we gather here to do, where I say something about, you know, contest of power over reproductive justice or something like that. And I wrote that in, like, I probably finalized that in 2020. Like, obviously the stakes have been high, but like to actually see it and live through this book falling into the world at a very particular time that necessitates the stories that it's trying to tell, it's just, I don't know, it's teaching me something about trust in myself. And it's kind of like affirming that I feel like now that this work is out, I feel a lot more playful when it comes to writing. Like, I feel like I did the big kind of like self autopsy work, and now I can like do other things that I'm really excited and curious about. Thank you.
Really, what I was thinking about when you were, I was thinking of that interview where Toni Morrison's, that interview was asking her like about like spirituality and like what she thought was and wasn't real. And then she talks about how after writing, I don't know if, I think the interview was about Song of Solomon, but she's talking about how, like, despite her training, like, that is where she had to go for the story. But it was through the writing that, like, she, it was like, it wasn't until she started writing that she realized that there was that, that reserve there or that world there. And it's certainly a little different, I think. Like, you don't strike me as someone who, it's not that, you know, you're sort of grad school training or anything, put up those walls, but even then, like, it is amazing at what comes out the woodwork. Even if you think you're pretty privy or pretty attuned to the walls, you're like, oh, there are levels that, yeah, they're like, you know, a video game of like locking subsequent levels. It's annoying in one way, but it is also humbling in another to be like, oh, okay, like, there's literally some shit I can't. Like, the other thing that came to me is like, oh, maybe like listening is a form of prescience, you know, like maybe it's not like you having to like get the cheat code into the future. But if you just listen, like you said, if you just listen to yourself when you wanted to tell your father about the peaches, then the universe is like, okay, I got some peaches.
Literally, it's like, oh, you want to talk about peaches? I got you. Just, you thought you was being like silly and experimental and you're actually like channeling. Yeah, it's deep. And I think there is a way that, like, I didn't realize, or I had taken for granted, how despite all the work that I did to be, you know, I'm a feeling person. I've been that way since I started grad school, but there were ways that I was numb or blocked off, or I was preoccupied. And so even just in this past month, like, the continual crises, the mass shootings, things have been hitting so hard where I was really like, where, like, I thought I was feeling before and I was, but the level of like visceral impact that the world is having on me since like having finished grad school is some whole other stuff. And I'm like, and I thought that I was open, you know, I thought that I was like, you know, feeling one, I'm not numb, like, I'm here. And I was, but there's just, you don't even realize the blinders that you have on or the kind of protective casings that are around you. Because I might not have been able to finish if I was as like perceptive as I feel now. And that's another reason why I'm looking sideways at the academy, because I'm like, I don't know if I can afford to choose that, like, that level of that level of isolation where I feel dead in some ways, and unavailable to the world in ways that feel important to this moment in time.
Especially when the job calls on you to be hyper alive in other
ways.
That's
the thing. And I feel like, I know we're winding down, but I was talking to like some other like colleague comrades who also graduated just now, and like, it would be so easy to be, you know, the next brilliant flaming hot star coming to your campus, da 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 da, and then fizzle the fuck out, like, and not be well. And that has happened, like, I've watched it happen in my time at Berkeley. People who we still don't know where they at, you know,
just disappeared.
Mm-hmm. And I don't want that for myself. There's been enough Black feminist blood. There's been enough Black queer blood sacrificed on these altars. Like, we can do something different. And that feels scary and weird to say, but it also feels really urgent.
Yeah, it's terrifying. But the alternative is, yeah. It is. It's like the difference between a terrifying known thing and a terrifying unknown. But no, I like that.
And maybe you get, I'm like, maybe you can get, like, I don't know. I like what you're saying. There's a terrifying unknown. And it doesn't have to be black and white, you know? It's not like, I remember something Eula says, like, people are always like, the academy's killing Black women. And she's like, the world is killing Black women. Like, that's what's happening. And I feel that. And I think what I have to remind myself is that I'm entitled to choose the conditions for my life. Yeah. You know, I don't have to just go along with the go along. And if I want to do it in an academic context and I can like consent in whatever way I can to the terms that that places on me, then sure. But I think we're all entitled to that terrifying unknown. At least I think it's worth the experiment. So. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. At least to say, you're the reason you did the thing, you know. Well, that's it. That's it. Shit. What that's more can we tell y'all?
That's it. Wow.
Well, before we bounce, are there places online or IRL that folks can find your work or support your work or buy the book?
Yeah. Buy the book from your local independent bookstore, Extra Points, if it's Black. You could also get it from like Red Hem Press. Like you could get it anywhere you can get books. I just am like trying not to keep the Bezos pockets fat. I'm also gonna be.
Yeah, you can get it. You can get it on bookshop.org if you want to buy online, but get it delivered from a local seller. That's what I'm trying to do. There we
go. Bookshop.org. Mm-hmm. There's also. Wow, I was like, there are other things. Like coming in the future, folks who are in the Bay, my collaborator Miyuki and I from the Church of Black Feminist Thought are going to have a like intervention installed in this Hella Feminist show being put on by the Oakland Museum of California. That opens at the end of July, and it should be cute and exciting. And then folks in the South, I'm going to have some work up at Antenna Gallery in New Orleans from like July 9th to August 20th something or another. It's like a little, it's not really a solo show because all my work is so collaborative, but some works from the Church of Black Feminist Thought and some other collaborations are in this show that I'm calling Marvels of My Own Inventiveness. Shout out to Spillers. And I'm really excited about that. And yeah, I think that's all I got. I got a website, ramalikaimhotep.com.
It's a very
little kind of website on socials.
I'm like, yeah, you busy. I was scrolling like, God damn. Wow. Okay. So many places to plug in. thank you for kicking it with
me. Thank you so much for this invitation and for like, it felt affirming when you were like, yeah, like I got your book. Let's talk about it like that. Cause I regard you, as a fellow poet scholar being. So thank you for seeing and holding me in my little book.
Always. I appreciate
that. Thank you. I feel like, you know, the little pot, it feels like a club. Like, I'm like, yes, I'm on the abolitionist podcast with all the serious thinkers of this moment and the clowns, which I love. I love being with the thinkers and the clowns and the queer.
You know, that's what this should be a place for. It's the circus of thought. Thank you so much for tuning in. And remember, you can follow us on Twitter at abolitionish. You can follow us on Instagram at abolitionishpod. And dun 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 dun, you can become a monthly supporter of this work by visiting patreon.com/abolitionish. I, John, do not profit at all, although I would like to because I am greedy. All of that money goes to pay our team and our guests. And any monthly donation you give us gets you access to our monthly zine and notes, which, if I do say so myself, is pretty fucking good. It gives you an inside peek into the minds of our guests, our team, and the people in our orbit who we love and are thinking with all the time. So, give us that $5 if you got it, baby. And if not, we got you on the flip side. And I look forward to seeing you on the other side of something better. And if not, I'll see you niggas later.